problem in our society, and it's not just a problem in alleys and in poor neighborhoods and other places. It's among us in every way. And as Chad pointed out last night, as our society loses its connection to God, there's a hole created. And nature, including human nature, hates a vacuum. And so it's going to be filled with something. And unfortunately, trying to fill that God-shaped hole with anything else is going to end up being destructive. And I think that's what the next lesson is going to be discussing. I'm privileged to be here. Always enjoy being here with this good congregation. This is a fairly heavy topic to deal with. And again, great lesson last night, and I'm hopeful that that trend and that bar will be continue to be met. In the interest of truth in advertising, I have to tell you this lesson this morning is not going to be pretty. It's not. It's not even an easy lesson for me to give, because all I'm going to be doing is identifying the problem. I'm not going to be able to give you a solution, and that, as a man, I hate that. And all of you men, maybe even all of you wives, know that when husbands are given a problem, they want to solve it. They don't want to just listen to it. They don't want to just talk about it. And so I'm going against every gene in my body to do that this morning. Let's read James 1, verses 13 through 15. When tempted, no one should say, "God is tempting me." For God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he tempt anyone, but each one is tempted when, by his own evil desire, he is dragged away and enticed. Then, after desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is full grown, gives birth to death. I want to begin this morning by looking at addictions in a nutshell, and kind of describing what it is, and then we'll move on through some other issues with regards to what it looks like, what happens to it, then I'm going to be done. And I'm going to leave you on a low note, just the stark reality of addiction. Addiction is a method of coping with the pressures of life. And some addictions do have a genetic component. Perhaps there's a chemical tendency that runs in a family. You can see that in family trees. If you've got alcoholics in your background, chances are you have that chemical dependency there. Workaholics, eating disorders, any of those things. Some are environmental, as in sexual addictions, or as a result of emotional or physical abuse. Some simply result from bad habits. We talked a little bit about habits and addictions. I'll bring up a little bit more about that in a moment. Smoking, gambling, overspending, compulsive exercise. You can see I don't have that problem. Some are the results of the company that we keep, the people that we hang around. Whatever the source, we're employing an ungodly release from whatever pressure or stress that we have in our life. And so it's a coping, not only with pressure, but it's also a coping method that doesn't include God. Instead of casting our cares and in prayer, going to the Lord, instead of having faith that he's going to provide for me everything that I need, instead of believing that he will not allow me to be tempted above what I'm able to bear, instead of taking his promised way of escape that is there, and instead of seeking his guidance and his wisdom, whether through his word or through godly men and women who are around me, I choose to cope with it on my own, in my own way. Never was Proverbs 14:12 so true as, "There is a way that seems right unto a man, but the end thereof is the way of death." Even Jeremiah 10:23 said, O Lord, I know that the way of man is not in himself. It's not in man that walks to direct his own steps. This is my way. I'm going to do it my way. Paul Anka wrote a song entitled "My Way" that was very much popularized by Frank Sinatra and Elvis Presley and others. It has become the humanist anthem. I will do it my way. And my way always is going to lead me away from God and away from the way that I should be going. Let me add right here as well that what we're talking about is not, and this was mentioned by Chad last night, we're not talking about properly prescribed medications for depression or other mental issues. The fact that you need them the rest of your life does not equate addiction. If that's the case, I'm addicted. Every night I take lisinopril and hypochlorothiazide and a baby aspirin every single night. I'll have to do that the rest of my life. Otherwise, my blood pressure will go back up to the 215 over 185 when they first diagnosed me with high blood pressure. I know. I was a stroke waiting to happen. True physical need, properly prescribed medications by a professional doesn't equate addiction as we are looking at it. We're dealing with a moral, spiritual problem here, not a physical imbalance. Proverbs, the 23rd chapter, and I don't think I have that passage on the overhead. See, I'm dating myself too. When Chad said I'm dating myself, I thought, well, that's because you couldn't get a date with anybody else. But that's just what I thought last night. It went right through, and I thought, I'll never tell anybody that. Proverbs chapter 23, starting at verse 29. Who has woe? Who has sorrow? Who has strife? Who has complaints? Who has needless bruises? Who has bloodshot eyes? Those who linger over wine, who go to sample bowls of mixed wine. Do not gaze at wine when it is red, when it sparkles in the cup, when it goes down smoothly. In the end, it bites like a snake and poisons like a viper. Your eyes will see strange sights and your mind imagine confusing things. You'll be like one sleeping on the high seas, lying on top of the rigging. They hit me, you will say, but I'm not hurt. They beat me, but I don't feel it. And when will I wake up so I can find another drink? That's addiction. And it doesn't have to be alcohol. It can be food. It can be drugs. It can be pornography. It can be work. It can be gambling. It can be exercise. It can be a substance or it can be a behavior. Whatever it is, it's something that we do to escape reality. And eventually then it becomes our escape through reality becomes something that masters us. Addiction occurs when we thought what was an escape becomes a trap, and what we thought was going to be freedom ends up to be a prison to us. It has nothing to do with our health. It has nothing to do with our well-being as prescribed by a physician. We might add here as well that this method of escape that we're using, that we have adopted ourselves, is destructive. Listen, habits are not bad in themselves. A habit is something you can control. An addiction is a habit that you can't control any longer. It's controlling you. And that's really the difference between those two things. Philippians, the fourth chapter, and we'll be talking about that at length tomorrow, tells us that we need to form habits. Form habits of the mind. Think on these things. Think constantly on these things. So habits are not bad. However, the habits we're forming in addictions, they are destructive. They take us away from God, and ultimately, they master us. If you look at 1 Corinthians, the 6th chapter, and verse 12, the Apostle Paul says, everything is permissible for me, but not everything is beneficial. Everything is permissible for me, but I will not be mastered by anything. Habits are fine, but when the habit masters you, then you've got a problem. Then you are no longer in control. Our master is no longer Christ. In fact, our master is no longer ourselves. It's the thing we're addicted to. So you go back to our text that we read just a moment ago there in James, the first chapter. And we're tempted. The thing that's tempting us here is taking us away from whatever pressure or problem, whatever it is that we're trying to get free from, release from, And so that desire for that, rather than seeking that kind of help and guidance from God, we're taking this other path, and it entices me, and when it conceives, it bears sin in my life, and the sin, when it's full grown, kills me. And I'm not talking about physical death. I'm talking about your spirit. So again, what I thought was bringing me life actually brings me death. That's the irony of addiction. Whatever the origins of addiction, there are consistent patterns of thought, there are consistent patterns of behavior that overpower that person's life, which is exactly the opposite of the goal of the addict, which is, in essence, to take control. They're wanting to take control of his or her life. And so I want to give you some criteria here of addictive behavior so you can recognize signs of trouble in your life or in the life of someone that you care about. And the first criteria, the first sign, is that addictive behavior always involves fantasy. Our desire begins to formulate some way we can avoid or void the stress in our lives, and we're diverted from reality to fantasy. And listen, in the fantasy, our stresses magically disappear. They're gone. And that's really what the passage in James comes to the fore, because we're drawn away by that. We desire that. We desire the freedom and the loss of care and concern. And those fantasies then are nurtured because they begin to take on a life of their own. That stress modified by whatever behavior, whether you're talking about chemical and adding things to our bodies in the form of drugs or what have you, whether it's sexual, whether it's an endorphin that comes as a result of exercise. Listen, the emotional rewards that we get from those things become preoccupied with those. We want that. So we can't wait to take a drink. We can't wait to pop the next pill or to take a hit on some joint. The need for sexual stimulation outside of the norm, of getting an endorphin from exercise or eating or not eating. Those things trigger a physiological response in us, and just thinking about it, just thinking about having that arouses us and excites us. And the power of fantasy is the enduring power of addiction. The thing that we're seeking for is what fuels that addiction. And listen, that's the first step. When you move from reality of life and God to a life of fantasy and sin, you're moving well along the path to being addicted. The second criteria is that we are going to attempt to medicate our emotions. And maybe that, Chad, is one of the things that you were talking about last night with regards to disease. Disease, you don't medicate emotions in disease. Our feelings are altered when we engage in this addictive behavior. We get the temporary relief of the stress, and we create this unnatural euphoria. And for a time, whenever we're involved in that, life is better. The chaos that's involved in our minds is relieved. This relationship that we're creating with our addiction is more consistent than any other relationship you have. Your relationship with your addiction hardly ever fails you. It's always there for you. And when they are embraced, they give pleasure a majority of the time. I mean, listen, how many of us can talk about any other relationship that we have that is the majority of the time, it's wonderful? They're more reliable than a friend. They're more reliable than a spouse. They're more reliable than anyone else. Consequently, your addiction becomes your strongest relationship. The thing that you cling to, the thing that you trust in. And of course, the other edge of that sword is it takes more and more and more to achieve that euphoria. You and I all, just as a result of things, we develop a tolerance. You can see that in your regular life, your daily life. I was, as you know, I was a meat cutter for many years. I worked in a little retail shop, you know, old-fashioned shop, and we had slabs of bacon and hams and sausage and all that stuff in there, you know, and German sausage and bolognese and, I mean, all that kind of stuff. And people would come in and say, oh, I wish I could work here. It must be wonderful just to walk in and smell all of that. And I don't smell it. I grew so tolerant of it. I used to think that when I'd drive by the bakery and say, man, I'd love to work in there. I love smell baked bread. Listen, those bakers, they don't smell baked bread anymore. And you, this euphoria that you're seeking from your addiction, sooner or later, you're going to tolerate it and you're going to have more. You're going to have more. And so we move on to harder substances or more radical experiences to regain that initial high and euphoria that we had, and we're drawn deeper and deeper into the addiction, and we have less and less to show for it. It gives us a false sense of control. And listen, this is the big lie of addiction, that it helps us control our lives. It does not help you control your life. It is controlling your life. And listen, maybe I should add this as well. I'll just ask. I think I can do this. How many of your lives have stress? Just raise your hand if you have stress in your life. You are kidding me. And all of us have stress in our lives. There's not anybody who's alive that doesn't have stress. Life at times, in fact, can feel overwhelming to everyone. You, if you're having a struggle with an addiction, or your friend who has, they are not alone in stress or even in feeling overwhelmed. But the choice of the addict is to escape it on their own. And they discount other means as inadequate or ineffective because of their unique situation. Other people don't understand. A person with anger issues will look for a session. They'll look for a reason to be angry. They may even create one. I think Homer Haley must have had anger issues. He told me one day, because he was a boxer, and he was a scrapper when he was growing up in Arizona and West Texas. He told me one day, he said, I'd fight at the drop of a hat. And sometimes I'd drop the hat. Person with anger issues will look for opportunities to be angry. A sex addict will prefer a session with internet porn rather than a loving relationship with a spouse. A nicotine addict will schedule their day around having a cigarette break. The one area not sought with an addict is to address the cause of the stress. Instead, they opt for the mood change of whatever they are addicted to. The alcoholic will claim that his marriage is bad and opt for a drink rather than maybe going to marriage counseling, which is the problem. The money addict will avoid financial problems by going on a shopping spree rather than sitting down and making a budget. You're going to hear this mantra, I'm sure, all weekend long. Addictions don't help you control your life. They increase the stress. They increase the chaos, which in turn drives the addict deeper and deeper into his or her addiction. And so the downward spiral begins to pick up speed. The other aspect of this is self-nurturing. The addict decides for himself when he will indulge or she will indulge and how much. especially the amount of stress that will be allowed to be to build up before it is addressed. Because timing and anticipation are a big part of this process. The addict wants to create the perfect and proper setting and what will help them feel nurtured. And so they look forward to a party where drinking can occur. They'll make time to make sure they get to the bathroom so they'll have opportunity to vomit after they've had a good meal, if that's their addiction. And they'll make sure that they can get alone for the internet. They'll put their computer in a particular place where it can't be seen. And the levels are also controlled, almost always, as we've already pointed out, trending to more and more each time to achieve that level of euphoria. A Chinese proverb concerning alcoholism says, one drink is too many and 10,000 drinks is not enough. Oftentimes you'll see additional or secondary addictions that are brought in. You'll take pills in the morning to get energy. You'll use nicotine during the day to build up that energy. And then at night you'll drink alcohol or look at porn, whatever, to relax. This self-nurturing will cause the addict to wait until the stress builds so that their feeling of euphoria can be the most, can be the greatest. And the last criteria of addictive behavior is it is always self-destructive. All addictions have this component of being self-destructive. And while it seems contrary to the control and the self-nurturing and aspects that the addict is pursuing, it's nonetheless true that it is a destruction of self. And there's always, I think, and experts say, obviously I'm not one of those degreed persons here, but I would feel it in myself, that there's always an underlying experience of guilt, of embarrassment, a violation of personal values, of broken promises. Listen, it's a life of deception. You're deceiving yourself and you're deceiving others constantly. How could you not feel guilty about that? Which in turn results in self-hatred, feelings that we need to be punished, which results in more and more and deeper addictive behavior. And so the downward cycle gets even greater momentum. I know you're waiting for me to get to the bottom of this pile. One of the things, when my father-in-law was a pilot taking flying lessons, and he took me flying with him every once in a while, little Cessna 110, I think, or 150, I can't remember. Anyway, I got to hold the yoke and, you know, do the whole thing. And so he had me go like that, so we went down, you know, and then he said, pull it up. And he said, now what happens if you just keep going down and you get enough speed, you'll cease to become a flying object because you won't be able to pull it up. You become a projectile. And man, did that stick with me. Listen, that is addiction. You think you're flying high, but there's going to come a time when you're going to become a projectile and out of control. And you'll crash and you'll die because you're no longer in control. So let's look at some quick bottom lines here. First one is we become addicted to sin. And the best example I can give you of that is Israel in the time of the judges. There's this cycle that they went through of apostasy where the thing that they were addicted to was the idolatry. And listen, idolatry wasn't just bowing down to a piece of wood or rock. I mean, there's partying and feasting and sexual activity and all of the stuff that went with that. That was the draw of idolatry, the temporal and physical pleasure that brought. And then God would punish them, and so they would go into servitude. He would bring someone in to punish them for that, which in turn would turn their hearts back to God, and there would be a restoration of them coming back to God. And as you read through the Judges, There's several cycles of that happening, of falling away, of servitude, and then being restored. But it wasn't a static cycle. In 1 Timothy, the third chapter, excuse me, 2 Timothy, and I'd even, 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 13, Paul says, while evil men and imposters will go from bad to worse, deceiving and being deceived. That's the tendency of sin. It goes from bad to worse. Israel's cycle wasn't just like this. Don't think of it as a flat circle of sin and punishment and restoration, and that it was level like this. Think of it as a cyclone, and it just spiraling down worse and worse. And when they were restored, they never quite got back to where they were before. And when they went away, they got worse than they were before. And I'll tell you the interesting thing that the last time that I studied the judges is that I noticed, look at the character of the judges. You go from guys like Othniel and Ehud, who were righteous, holy men serving God, to the last, before you get to Samuel, the last judge is Samson. And all of the character of the judges also descends. Do you have a guy who's a womanizing, well, let's just leave it right there, who God is using to bring his people back? In Hebrews, the third chapter, and verses 12 through 13, the Hebrew writer says, see to it, brothers, that none of you has a sinful, unbelieving, and in that sense, refusing to believe heart, that turns away from the living God. But encourage one another daily as long as it's called today, so that none of you may be hardened by sin's deceitfulness. Addiction turns us away from God. It's turning to ourselves. It's turning to self-indulgence. And there is a numbing effect by that. There is a hardening of our hearts where we're not, it doesn't hurt us anymore. It doesn't bother us anymore. The sense of guilt and shame is taken away to the point that we can get to in 1 John, the first chapter, and verse 8 through 10, where you get to the point where I don't have sin. I deny that I have sin. I say that I don't have sin. If we claim we have not sinned. We become addicted to it. Secondly, addiction is habitual sin. Again, in 1 John, the third chapter, this time in verses 4 through 6, everyone who sins breaks the law. In fact, sin is lawlessness. But you know that he appeared so that he might take away our sins, and in him is no sin. No one who lives in him keeps on sinning. No one who continues to sin has either seen him or known him. You keep on sinning. You sin, your life becomes sinful. I mean, that's the character of your life. You get to the point you don't even know God. You don't know him any longer. Again, back in 1 Corinthians, the sixth chapter, and we referred to this a moment ago, 1 Corinthians chapter 6, starting at verse 12, that, you know, nothing will be, won't allow anything to master. Notice starting at verse 13, food for the stomach and stomach for food, but God will destroy them both. The body is not meant for sexual immorality, but for the Lord, and the Lord for the body. By his power, God raised the Lord from the dead, and he will raise us also. Do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ himself? Shall I then take the members of Christ and unite them with a prostitute? Never. Do you not know that he who unites himself with a prostitute is one with her in body? For it is said the two will become one flesh, but he who unites himself with the Lord is one with him in spirit. And then he goes on and talks about fleeing sexual immorality. Listen, your body and your spirit are inseparable to serving God. You say, I knew that. Think about it. Your body is the only tool God has given you to use to serve him. Your spirit is inside and it's in control. And when you take that and start using it for yourself, then you are no longer using it for God. While Chad was preaching last night, I was thinking about that, this connection between the spirit and the body. And so he held up a National Geographic that, listen, humanists, evolutionists, atheists, however you want to refer to them, They don't believe that you have a spirit. They believe you're just a body. Come down the spiritual spectrum, and then you have the Gnostics. The Gnostics believe that you have a spirit and that you have a body, but the Gnostics believe there's no connection between those two. What you do in your body doesn't have a connection to your spirit. And then you come down to what is actually the middle, and you have the truth, and that is that your body and your spirit are connected. You have both. And I was thinking this morning, okay, where can I go? Where's my spectrum go? So let me take you over here to Christian Scientists. They don't really believe you have a body. You're just a spirit. You're not really here. And then at the end over here is a rock. No body, no spirit. You are connected. That's why in this text, in 1 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 20, Paul says in the last phrase there, therefore honor God with your body. That's not possible with an addiction in whatever form of habitual sin that you're involved in. You cannot serve it and God. That's what Matthew, the 6th chapter and verse 24 says. It's not possible. You cannot serve God and mammon. You can't serve, as my translation has, God and money. You cannot serve God, and you insert whatever addiction that you have in there. You can't serve both of them. And he's not saying you cannot in the sense of permission. You may not. It's not what he said. You cannot. It's impossible. You can't do it. You're not going to be able to find a way in order to do that. And the consequence of all of this, of course, is separation from God. It's spiritual death and a hopelessness in that state. Remaining in the addiction confines you to that state of existence which is apart from God, separated from Him. And so again, as we said at the very beginning, what you believe to be an escape now turns into your prison. And in fact, what you thought was freedom now is a trap to you. I told you that the lesson wasn't going to be pretty. And again, this lesson isn't intended to provide a cure. Rest assured, that lesson is coming. There's a lot going on here. But mine is just to kind of give you a stark picture of what addiction is, to identify the problem. And the real problem of addiction is that your spirit is slain. It's not DTs or pain or the real problem is the fact that you're spiritually killing yourself or have killed yourself. And I hope you know that if it's you or someone you love that has an addiction, I hope that you will see the need to escape and realize that there is a way. If I can just give one little tiny glimmer of hope in my lesson here this morning, that is that there is a way of escape that you can successfully navigate, you can find. And again, those lessons are coming. So thank you. I think Kyle has a song for us to sing. Let's stand and sing it together.